chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off with a Greg Reese pronouncement here about the iris of the eye and how the banks are going to use that. But here we go with Greg Reese.
In 1975, New York City was over $11 billion in debt, and the banks were no longer there to bail them out. Instead, the bankers made them sweat, never showed up to the meeting, and then created a committee that they controlled so that the banks could manage the city directly. This has been brilliantly documented in the Adam Curtis film, Hypernormalization.
The announcement on behalf of the controller is that the offer, which we had expected to receive and announce at 2 o'clock this afternoon, is now expected at 4 o'clock.
Well, does this mean that so far nobody wants those bonds?
We will be making a further announcement at 4 o'clock, and anything further that I could say now, I think, would not advance the interest of the sale, which is now in progress.
Does this mean that you have not been able to sell them so far today?
We will have a further announcement at 4 o'clock.
What happened that day in New York marked a radical shift in power. The banks insisted that in order to protect their loans, they should be allowed to take control of the city. The city appealed to the president, but he refused to help. So a new committee was set up to manage the city's finances. Out of 9 members, 8 of them were bankers. It was the start of an extraordinary experiment where the financial institutions took power away from the politicians and started to run society themselves.
That was nearly 50 years ago, and so you can be sure that the banks manage everything now. Politicians are merely their puppets, which was recently made blatantly obvious with the public display of Dianne Feinstein and her handlers.
I would like to support a yes vote on this. It provides $823 billion. That's an increase of $26 billion for the Department of Defense. And it funds priorities submitted.
Yeah, just say aye.
Okay, just...
Aye. Thank you.
Politicians are only there to keep the people divided and distracted, and they have so far been hugely successful at that. While a cashless society is slowly being built around us, everyone is hyper-emotional about something else and focused on fighting each other, which is most certainly exactly what the banks were shooting for. Because once they get us off of cash and completely onto a digital system, then the banks will have absolute control over each and every one of us.
A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control.
It's not just about digital forms of physical currency. You can have programmability, units of central bank currency with expiry dates, where the government decides that units of central bank money can be used to purchase some things, but not other things that it deems less desirable, like, say, ammunition.
Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
What a fine insight that he does. Greg Reese does a wonderful job. Coming up next is the dark journalist, interviewed by Alex, and he's talking about gaining control again when Trump was in office of the UFO file. So this is very important insight. So here we go with the dark journalist and Alex.
It's extraordinary that Space Force ever happens. I don't dream. Trump doesn't get the credit that he deserves on that. But here's the thing. The Space Force was about pulling the UFO file back under presidential control. It had been lost in the late 50s under Eisenhower. So think of how long it had been lost. Trump went in there and, you know, suddenly you had to start peeling people off the ceiling with their reaction to him. And it's not just, oh, he had all these, you know, he was a loudmouth billionaire real estate guy. This is a guy who's sitting at the table across from them, and he's on the same level with them around the UFO file because of his uncle. This is the nature of the problem that they have with Trump. And let's not forget Roy Cohn and his deep involvement with Trump and setting Trump up early on. So
that's right. Trump is totally connected to the super right wing, pro-human deep state, if you want to call it that. Roy Cohn at the very top of the McCarthy hearings. A bunch of Trump's family involved in secret Tesla technology. I mean, the Trumps are something else, and they know Trump knows a lot of that. Well, to say all hell's breaking loose is an understatement. All hell is breaking loose. Congress launches hearings on interdimensional alien invaders. While all over national corporate-controlled news, the system calls for using Homeland Security against the right wing. For our speech, Mitt Romney calls for going after free speech. MSNBC leftist calls for post-9/11 style crackdown to prevent Americans becoming too patriotic. I'm not joking. We'll play the clip in a moment. Mitt Romney argues it shouldn't be illegal for government to use big tech for censorship. If what you're saying's wrong, oh, but you define what's wrong. You say two men can have a baby. I say that's wrong. I get censored. Republican bill that allows citizens to sue federal employees that collude to censor speech. Yeah, it's already legal. Vivek says if Twitter supports free speech, unban Alex Jones. That video is up on Infowars.com. Appreciate Vivek, who's now number two behind Trump. He's now surpassed DeSantis, saying that. Number two Republican candidate. Poll, millennials say misgendering should be a crime. Gen Zs disagree. Well, the good news is in a republic, it doesn't matter what your opinion is about somebody's speech. They're allowed to have it. In a democracy, if 51% say arrest someone for speech, it happens. In a constitutional republic that is a little d-democracy, those basic rights are enshrined and protected. And that's important right now because the system's going down. And it planned to bring things down, to bring in the new global digital currency, the Great Reset, the Build Back Better. But I pointed this out for decades that when they made their big globalist move around 2020, because they said they would back in 1992 at the Rio de Janeiro Accord with the UN, they said by 2020 we're going to launch the transformation. And by 2030, we want to have a massive depopulation and the end of the industrial world. Now those are quotes. We'll just type in what I said. Agenda 2030, Agenda 2020, Agenda 2021. And so piggybacked on all of this is the holy grail of control to completely discombobulate the public. And that's little green men. Sorry, eating lunch during the break. Little green men from space. And all these couch terms they use about biologics and things. Well, biologics, non-human biologics could be a banana in a crash craft or bacteria or a monkey or a rabbit or maybe little elves from Pluto. But this is just a wild time to be alive. I've got a whole bunch of clips here. The first one I want to play and then get Dark Journalist's take, who's kind enough to come back with us 2 days in a row, darkjournalist.com, one of the leading experts and filmmakers. One of the smartest people on the subject. I want to play this first clip. That's clip four. Interdimensional beings, holographic principles being talked about in congressional hearing. But beyond interdimensional, we know under Project Bluebeam type systems, which they admit they have, you've seen in China them project a giant 3,000-foot-long dragon with drones that flies around. Or they can use holograms to do it. Or they can have jellyfish flying around. Or they can have a demon. It's like 3 o'clock somewhere. No, my shirt popped up. But sorry, that wasn't on purpose. So all of this is going on. A crazy, crazy time to be alive. So here's the clip, and then we'll go through a bunch of these clips in the next hour with Dark Journalist. Here's the first one.
With that being said, you have mentioned that there's interdimensional potential. Could you expound on that?
Oh, yeah, to answer your first question, and you know, I'm here as the fact witness and expert, but I will give you a theoretical framework at least to work off to kind of espouse crashes regardless of, you know, your level of sentience, right? You know, planes crash, cars crash, N number of sorties, however high, a small percentage are going to end in, you know, mission failure, if you will, as we say in the Air Force. And then in terms of, multidimensionality, that kind of thing, the framework, that I'm familiar with, for example, is something called the holographic principle. It derives itself from general relativity and quantum mechanics. And that is, if you want to imagine a 3D object such as yourself casting a shadow onto a 2D surface, that's the holographic principle. So you can be projected, quasi-projected from higher dimensional space to lower dimensional. It's a scientific trope that you can actually cross. Literally, as far as I understand, but there's probably guys with PhDs that we could probably argue about that.
But you have not seen any documentation that that's what's occurring.
Only a theoretical framework discussion.
Yep. And look, yesterday, myself and Dr. Beeney were kind of attacking that guy because his opening statement did sound like it was pretty cooked up. He sounds more credible there. And again, we're not saying this stuff doesn't exist, but the rollout now, the way it's being done with all these other hearings and the system is in doubt, the globalists, the Bilderberg leaks always said, when our system starts collapsing, one of the big things is a virus, a mass power outage, a war, a mix of those, or the coup de grace, the really special sauce, the secret weapon, fake alien invasion. And so it looks to me like they're taking it out of deep freeze as a plan and kind of warming it up, getting ready to serve it. Dark Journalist with piercing analysis, darkjournalist.com. Thank you so much for joining us again. What, now you've had time to digest those incredible hearings yesterday, what's your take?
Alex, it's great to see you. You know, the hearings were really a disgrace when you consider the amount of knowledge that exists inside the secret government relating to this and how much they're just rolling this out now after the intelligence community, deep inside the intelligence community around the UFO file, has been the most secret division in the entire government, with the secrecy of the UFO file above the atomic bomb starting in the 50s. So, you know, we're looking all the way back to this UFO secrecy, and they've just kept the entire development behind a wall of secrecy. Now, after all this development, they want to roll out a version, and what they're using is traditional UFO tropes, as it were, and they have Grush out there really stumbling around with these phrases, not providing any data for us to look at, and anytime a tough question comes up, this guy wants to run off to the skiff because he doesn't have a good answer for it, and God knows what he would say in the skiff. You know, they won't let me talk about it. So there's a lot of secondhand information, the way that they're doing this, very much like the Warren Commission as a model, as a framework, where they float a bunch of things right on the top of it. Well, you know, maybe this was involved, but they keep getting you right back to the target of the lone gunman. In this case, the target is, oh, there's UAP, you know, which is a false name for UFOs, and that they're a threat. And it's interesting, he showed the Oppenheimer clip there. There's a guy who worked with Oppenheimer whose name was Robert Saarbarker, and he's been erased largely from history. He's the physicist who said, yeah, I worked on the UFO file. We had a group that studied them. We studied the beings that we found inside and found that somebody had made these things, and they were kind of insect-like. So there's real on-the-record testimony in relation to this, and the whole headline around this guy coming out and the news media saying, well, this is the first time a government official has ever come forward and said anything, is completely junk conspiracy, as it were. And so, you know, from my point of view, the hearings were a way, just like the hearings last year. The hearings last year didn't quite go as far as these hearings. These hearings went a little further by saying, oh, you know, we discovered biologics, which you pointed out doesn't mean anything. They didn't say, oh, we found an alien body and we have its DNA. They said we found biologics. So it's all very vague. And again, Grush, groomed by the Central Intelligence Agency, he's an intelligence career intelligence officer directly from the NRO. He's the front man they put out there. You might notice that the two Navy pilots they put out there had credible testimony of their sightings, and that's as far as they went. This guy, he has everything. He has alien bodies. He has crashed vehicles. He has rediscovery, regenerative programs around the UFO. You know, this is what we're talking about. This guy's supposed to be the all and everything answer. And,
sure. Plus, when I watch the Navy pilots, and I've talked to pilots that have seen this, and then I look at what's been leaked, what's been admitted previously that the Pentagon was working on, or concepts the Pentagon put out, It's funny how concepts in the 80s and 90s, 2000s is exactly what you see flying around the ships and flying around, and it's basically one agency with more advanced technology messing with another agency, or almost like 30 years ago, an F-14 flying over the beach in Hawaii and basically buzzing some people, but they don't know it's an F-14, so they're totally freaked out, and then again, that creates this fear, it creates this tension. And it's really the shadow government toying with the public and Congress and telling them, I'm here to tell you about above Congress information, as if we don't know there's a breakaway civilization. So it's the breakaway civilization itself introducing the breakaway civilization to Congress and the public so it can then basically play God and use its authority. I think you kind of alluded to that. I think that's dead on.
There were interviews and testimony, given before Congress this week on the subject of ETs and UFOs and so forth. So you can look into that and dig down into those YouTube files, video files. Now, coming up next, a very important thing happened. Hunter Biden was in court to have his plea bargain approved with the government. And the judge came in and upset the apple cart. And here is a live report given just minutes after the courtroom scene by Catherine Herridge with CBS. She's a wonderful reporter, and I'm giving this immediately after that because it's live stuff. They can't withdraw it, what they said. So here we go. It was a live report earlier in the week.
We have some breaking news right now. It appears that the plea deal reached between President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and federal prosecutors is dead. Under the agreement, Hunter Biden would have avoided prison time on the two misdemeanor tax charges.
That's right. There may still be time to work this out, but we want to get the latest information to you right now. Our CBS News senior investigative correspondent, Catherine Herridge, joins us from outside the courtroom where we understand conversations are still taking place. But, Catherine, you were there in the room. Let us know what just happened.
Well, good to be with you. Throughout the hearing so far, it's almost 2 hours. It was extremely tense, dramatic, and many unexpected turns. As it stands right now, there is no plea agreement between the president's son and the U.S. government. The U.S. attorney, when asked specifically by the judge about the understanding between the parties, he said there was, quote, no deal. And Hunter Biden's attorney, Christopher Clark, said that as far as he was concerned, the plea agreement was null and void. It's a lot of complex legal arguments, but it really comes down to a simple idea that there is an ongoing investigation by the U.S. attorney in Delaware. And whether you put that to one side, Hunter Biden could face criminal prosecution in the future on other charges. Hunter Biden's legal team believes that this was, in effect, a global agreement, sort of a one and done. He would do this plea. There would be a diversion program for this gun offense. But then that would be it. There would be no further prosecution. But the government's position is different. The government's position, as to hypothetical, if there could be charges in the future from the ongoing investigation, for example, violation of foreign lobbying laws, the representative of the U.S. attorney said, yes, that is possible. And that is when the entire deal fell down. I would note that when the judge came in today, frankly, she came in hot to this courtroom. She said that this diversion agreement on the gun charge included a lot of language that was not standard, terms that were not ordinary. So she came in with a lot of very pointed questions about whether this agreement was something that she was going to be asked to rubber stamp or whether she could really analyze and feel comfortable with. Errol and Lana.
Catherine, both parties came into court today believing that they had a deal in place. Is there any possibility, after you explained that both with the judge's questions and the representation by both sides that they had different positions on this, that a deal may still be struck today? Or is that off entirely?
Well, listen, a lot's happening in that courtroom while I'm down here talking to you. They've taken this recess, kind of a last-ditch effort to see whether they can have a meeting of the minds and whether they can salvage this plea agreement. Because remember, once that plea agreement is off the table, the trial clock is ticking. They're already talking about some pretrial motions and status hearings, at the beginning of September. So there's an effort to see if they can salvage it. Both parties wanted to come in here today, get the plea agreement on the two misdemeanor tax charges, then also this diversion program for the gun felony charge. That was the possession of a firearm by a drug user. But at this point, it does not appear that it will proceed. This is a major blow to both the defendant's legal team as well as the U.S. government. And it comes back to an idea that really caught my attention in June when this plea agreement was first announced. Hunter Biden's attorney Chris Clark said as far as they were concerned, this was the end of the road for his legal problems. But the U.S. Attorney's Office at that time said and confirmed that there was an ongoing investigation. And it's this gap, this daylight, which has really, I think, put the whole deal in question today.
And Catherine, you've done a great job in kind of resetting for our viewers what the plea agreement was. You mentioned he had pleaded guilty to possession of a handgun by a drug user. That's a felony. He had pleaded guilty to failure to pay taxes. That's a misdemeanor. Remind us of what the plea deal was and what Hunter Biden's reaction was in the room when this unfolded.
Right. Well, I just want to clarify something. Think about this deal as having two elements are being bifurcated. On the tax charges, these were two misdemeanors for the failure to pay taxes in 2017 and 2018. And what we learned in court today is that there were multiple reminders to Hunter Biden. He had the money to pay, but he failed to pay the IRS in excess of $100,000 for both of those tax years. On the separate track was this felony gun charge. Technically, he was not pleading guilty to that. He was going to enter what's called a diversion program, which, frankly, is a little unusual. Under the diversion program that was in the agreement, he would get the charge dismissed in the future if he abided by the terms. And a source close to the agreement had told CBS News that included no further criminal activity and no drug use. So those were the two buckets or the two elements, if you will.
And his reaction in the courtroom?
Yeah. You know, he came into the courtroom. I was maybe 20 feet behind him. You know, he was a lot of energy, you know, standing upright, very sort of outgoing, if you will. He shook hands with some of the people on the U.S. Attorney's team. He sort of nodded at the U.S. Attorney David Weiss, who's been leading this probe. But really, out of the gate, there was a lot of tension in that courtroom. It was clear to me from my vantage point that the judge had a lot of very serious questions about the structuring of this agreement, specifically the diversion program for the felony gun possession. And in the course of the hearing, we heard Hunter Biden say at one point that he only agreed to this plea deal because of the promises that he had been made for what could happen in the future, only to later reverse that. And as the hearing progressed, he seemed, in my view, sort of increasingly unsettled as to what was unfolding. Understandably, right? He came in here today expecting that the plea agreement would be behind him and he could move on with his life. And right now we're at a point where the last we heard officially in the court is there was no deal, and from the defense point of view that it was null and void. That could change. They could have a meeting of the minds in this recess, but that's the state of play.
All right, Catherine, thank you very much. We'll continue checking in with you throughout the
You're
day.
Welcome.
Now, later in the week, Sean Duffy interviewed Andy McCarthy. And here's what Andy McCarthy had to say about what happened in that courtroom, and that's why they were trying to fool and bamboozle the judge, and she wasn't going for it. So here we go with Andy McCarthy, interviewed by Sean Duffy.
All right, switching gears back to the Biden family scandals, with Hunter's plea deal completely blowing up earlier this week. Well, what's next for the big guy? Let's bring in Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney, National Review contributing editor, and Fox News contributor. Andy, good to see you. So let's talk about this, the deal that blew up, the immunity that was written into the diversion agreement, but not the Department of Justice didn't want to put it on the record, but they did put it in writing thinking they could slide it by the judge. What do you think of how this deal was structured?
Well, it's obviously very different, Sean, in that our adversarial criminal justice system depends on the defense lawyers looking out for the interests of the defendant, and set your timers for this, right? The Justice Department looking out for the interests of the American people, not the defendant. So what happened here is the two sides are in cahoots rather than adversarial, and you got an agreement that looks like it was basically written by Hunter's defense lawyers. The judge, to her credit, asked questions that judges don't normally have to ask because the agreement looked so different. Usually the immunity provision in a plea agreement is in the plea agreement, but here, as you say, they tucked it into the diversion agreement in connection with the gun that they weren't going to prosecute. And by the way, judges don't have to sign those diversion agreements. They only sign, you know, they only get involved in the plea agreement. So the whole thing was to try to sort of bamboozle her, and good for her not, for not letting them do it.
But listen, in state court back in Wisconsin when I was a prosecutor, if you were going to offer someone immunity, you would spell out what the immunity was for.
Right.
It didn't seem like the deal delineated any of the immunity that was offered. It seemed to be blanket. Is that odd in federal court?
Well, it's not only odd, Sean. It begs the next question, which is, now that the deal blew up, as somebody asked me the other day, so do they now have to go to trial? And my answer was, go to trial on what? Because just like they wouldn't describe the immunity in the plea deal, there's no indictment. They've never indicted this guy because they don't want to lay out the crimes that are involved here. If you laid out those crimes, you wouldn't be able to justify giving this guy a two misdemeanor count tax plea. It would be obvious the kind of stuff that the Biden family is into. And most importantly, they don't want to indict because as long as there's no indictment, the statute of limitations continues to run. So they've already lost the very important Burisma counts from 2014 and 2015. And the longer this goes, the more the case evaporates.
Yeah, no, it is baffling as a former prosecutor to see how the feds, the Department of Justice has treated this case. And so the party's going to come back to court in 30 days, give an update to the judge. When the first deal was struck, the one that just blew up, there wasn't as much attention around Hunter Biden. We didn't have the whistleblowers come out and testify on Capitol Hill about the interference that was run by the Department of Justice and the FBI, whether it was looking into the big guy or, you know, we didn't know they were giving tips off to the Hunter Biden team of search warrants to be executed. Now that we have that information, how do you think this new deal, if there is a deal, will be structured? What's going to happen 30 days from now?
It's hard to say because it looks to me like you can't really predict this on the basis of what you and I know about, which is the behavior of normal prosecutors and normal prosecutors' offices. This is unpredictable. If you had told me, asked me 2 days ago, what was going to happen in court, I would never have predicted, and I have like very low levels of expectation for the Biden Justice Department and Hunter Biden, but I would never have predicted what happened in court the other day. So it's hard to see going forward. I think, Sean, the one thing we can be sure of is they're pretty committed to toughing this out. They haven't appointed a special counsel in 2.5 years. And again, the longer there's no indictment, you know, another 30 days means the potential that more counts are lost. In October, for example, the statute of limitations runs on the gun charge. The 2016 tax year is if it's not already gone, it's going gone. So they're just toughing it out, I think.
So as we see the Department of Justice and the FBI run cover for the Biden family, which it appears that's the case, I asked Wesley Hunt this earlier in the show, but you had the 1023 where an informant to the FBI talked about the Biden family crime syndicate where Joe Biden received $5 million from Burisma for some policy help. That comes out, and it was exposed to members of Congress on the Hill. The very next day, Donald Trump's charged with crimes down in Mar-a-Lago, and then the deal blows up yesterday or 2 days ago with Hunter Biden, and the following day more charges come out against Donald Trump. Does this seem odd that or is this just a coincidence that you have Donald Trump charges coming right after there's publicity around all the crimes allegedly committed by the Biden family.
Yeah, well, I'm like an Occam's razor guy. Like, you know, the simplest explanation is the explanation. And I think if you assume that the Biden Justice Department is hyper politicized, then all of these things make sense. If you take that out, none of it makes sense. So I'm going to go with the thing that makes sense and say this is a political outfit. So when some bad news for the Bidens comes out, they have to step on it by, you know, other kinds of news.
It is disappointing. Okay, so we have Devin Archer, Hunter Biden's business partner. He was very close to the Bidens. He's going to testify on Monday. What can we expect from his testimony? How does this impact the public perception, but also the cases potentially against the Bidens?
Well, I don't think the Biden investigation that the Justice Department is running is real. I think it's a sham. And if it was real, they wouldn't be letting Devin Archer testify in Congress. They've already had him testify, Sean, in the grand jury. Now, we don't have a special counsel, right? So I have to think the reason they put him in the grand jury was to see what he would say, not to advance the investigation. And whatever he's going to say to Jamie Comer's committee is going to be behind closed doors. So we'll have to hear, you know, we'll have to wait what we hear about it. But I would not be holding my breath for a big advance in the criminal investigation of, you know, the Justice Department's investigation of the Bidens, even with Devin Archer, because I don't think they're serious about it.
Well, it's interesting. The White House, after the news of Devin Archer's testimony to The Hill came out, they've switched their story. Joe Biden has said for years that he never talked to his son about his business dealings. That's been the status answer from the White House and from Joe Biden. Now they've come out and said, well, Joe Biden was never in business with his son, Hunter Biden. So it seems like Devin Archer's testimony to The Hill, the anticipation of that is making the White House change their tune in regard to what involvement Joe Biden had with his son, Hunter Biden.
Yeah, I think that's right. To me, the most astonishing thing about that is how brazenly they insult your intelligence,
know.
You know, because when she said the other day he's never been in business with him, she said, as I've said 1,000 times. And of course, she had never said that before. That was a complete sea change in their version of events. But they look you in the eye and just don't tell the truth.
They lie to your face. They think we're stupid. Andy McCarthy, you have been a dog on the bone in this case. We appreciate all of your great reporting and insight. And thanks for joining me on Kudlow.
It's slowly coming out, isn't it? I mean, and not now. I mean, it's quickly coming out, all of this scandalous stuff. But next, we've got to Maria Bartiromo with Newt Gingrich, and they cover a plethora of differing angles on this. They not only talked about this Hunter episode recently, but they dwell upon several other very important political aspects. So here we go next with Newt Gingrich and Maria Bartiromo.
Welcome back. Top officials in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis' 2024 presidential campaign telling donors that a, quote, reset is underway in a meeting with top contributors on Sunday. They acknowledge too much money has been spent and they're promising more changes to rebound from a disappointing start. Meanwhile, President Trump keeping his commanding lead with GOP primary voters. A new Fox Business poll finds the former president now at 48% in South Carolina. DeSantis is sitting in third place at 13%. In Iowa, meanwhile, Trump is leading with 46%. DeSantis is at 16%. Joining me right now is former Speaker of the House and Fox News contributor Newt Gingrich. He's author of the new the book, March to the Majority. Speaker, it's always a pleasure. Great to see you.
Good to see you. Those
what
are amazing.
What do you think is going on
numbers.
With these polls? Yeah, let's talk about it. How do you assess where we are ahead of the debate?
Well, President Trump has half or more of the Republican base, I think, pretty well locked up. I think they're going to stick with him no matter what. The rest is scattered, but what people need to remember is we went through this in 2016, and I think there were a total of 16 candidates. And as they would drop out, people would say, oh, they're all going to go to the non-Trump candidate. That didn't happen. I just talked to one pollster 2 days ago who said that if DeSantis, for example, were to drop out, at least half of his vote would go to Trump. Well, you add that to what Trump already has, and he's back up above 60% against the entire field. So unless something really dramatically happens, I think that Trump is the almost inevitable nominee. No, nothing's totally inevitable in politics, but he certainly has massive advantages going into Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. And he could come out of those four having decisively won the nomination.
Yeah, but Newt, I mean, something extraordinary is happening. He got indicted twice, and he might get indicted a third time. How are these legal issues affecting all of this?
Well, I think he'll be indicted at least two more times. He'll be indicted probably, certainly in the District of Columbia, by the totally, I think, partisan Department of Justice, and he may be indicted in Atlanta by an equally partisan Democrat local district attorney. But I think what's happened is, in Trump's world, that's interpreted as persecution, not prosecution. And so people believe that this is a deliberate effort. And they look at how the Bidens are treated. They look at how Hillary Clinton was treated. And they say, you know, there's such a gigantic double standard here how can you possibly believe this is about the criminal justice system? This is an effort to use the law to destroy a political opponent, something which, frankly, has never been done in American history. And it's kind of astonishing that the Democrats are this desperate and that they're willing to manipulate and use the law this decisively. It's an example of the depth of their corruption.
Well, this is a really important point that you're making, and this is why we're looking at these developments around Hunter Biden. Devin Archer, his former business partner, is expected to testify under oath next week. And what we have from Miranda Devine is that Hunter Biden would dial into his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, on speakerphone, into meetings with his overseas business partners. This reported by Miranda Devine that Devin Archer is going to discuss next week. Is this ever going to hurt Joe Biden? Even Kevin McCarthy is saying some of this is rising to the levels.
Look, I think when Robert Kennedy Jr. said there has to be an investigation, you saw the beginning of a break in the whole dam. As facts weigh up day after day after day, at some point, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the big media conglomerates are going to realize they're on the wrong side of history. And as they do that, you'll see this the tide shift. Already you're seeing a little more coverage of the problems. You're seeing the New York Times beginning to behave as though maybe it's on the wrong side of these things. The Devin Archer, if he comes in, and again, the pressure on him to not testify is enormous. But if he does come in and he does say flatly, look, I was in the room, I saw it, there's no question it happened. First of all, it will prove conclusively that Joe Biden has lied to the entire country for years. Second, it will raise significant questions because so much of this money is foreign money. This isn't just your standard corruption problem. This is a foreign influence buying problem involving the President of the United States. And to the degree, I'm just now reading Ball of Collusion by Andy McCarthy, which was written way back in 2019. And it is astonishing how he takes apart all these things. And one of the things that led me to realize is Biden learned in part from Hillary Clinton. The Clintons used government to raise so much money that, and it's still never been investigated and should be. The Clinton Foundation became their device for huge amounts, I mean, $35 million in one case. So the Bidens, in that sense, are just kind of little thieves as compared to the Clintons, who were taking money on a grand scale. But Biden learned from that. You can do it. You can get away with it. There's no legal consequence. So why shouldn't I have the money, too? And so you have a guy who, at least since the vice presidency, has been taking money.
Yeah, and that's what the Burisma CEO said, according to these documents, that he said, we always knew Joe Biden was the most corrupt family in Washington and living in the White House, and that says a lot, given that the Clintons lived there. I mean, he actually said that, according to documents that we've got. Meanwhile, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, as I mentioned, escalating talks of impeachment in the face of these investigations into the family business. Here's what the House Speaker said this week. Watch.
If you're sitting in our position today, We would know none of this if Republicans had not taken the majority. We've only followed where the information has taken us. This is rising to the level of impeachment inquiry.
So Newt, where do you think this is going? Do you think we will see an impeachment? And does it matter at this point? What happens then?
Well, I think there's a huge challenge to impeaching and convicting President Biden, and that's Vice President Kamala Harris. I mean, no rational person wants her to be president. So you have this dilemma. You may have a corrupt and in some ways cognitively challenged president, but you have a totally inept vice president who would probably be, from this country's standpoint, even more dangerous. I think McCarthy's right, though. They should impanel an impeachment process because that opens up avenues of investigation they don't currently have.
Newt, I know you did a taped podcast with the producer and actor who made The Sound of Freedom, and you were very happy with that. Real quick on that, why was that so important to you?
Well, it's an amazing movie. I'm actually going, Cliff and I are going with Kevin McCarthy tonight. He's hosting a showing of it at the Capitol Hill. It is an important moral statement about the tragedy of children. And I think every American should see The Sound of Freedom.
Okay, the Newt Gingrich says it like it is. So very, very good interview there. So coming up next is Jay Dyer on this Barbie movie. You know, this Barbie movie was quite, I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment on it. But here we go with Jay Dyer and his opinion, and then I'll wrap it up right at the end. So thank you for listening tonight.
A profile of every human being, and through all of the research that cybernetics and MIT and Norbert Wiener and all these people have done for many, many decades, figuring out how to tweak the information in the feedback loop that comes to you through all the social media and through the feed to steer you in a certain direction. In fact, do you remember when Facebook some years ago came out with an admission that, we have been secretly doing a psychological experiment on a lot of our users? That's called social media. The whole thing is a psychological experiment to learn how to steer you in a certain direction. Then we had a whole crop of social media engineers, people like Jason Lanier, come out and give testimony and talk about how it was all geared towards steering the public in certain directions based on all of this stuff. Guess what? That's what the movie's about. But it's not just about steering you in certain directions. It's telling this narrative in a Gnostic way, which is very bizarre, because throughout a lot of these films, you'll see this Gnostic narrative, especially a lot of Hollywood films, you'll see the narrative that the creator God is the one that's imprisoning you and keeping you here as a slave. This is in a lot of Tom Cruise movies, Oblivion, Edge of Tomorrow. And then so you have this rebel figure who's this sort of Luciferian rebel that rebels against and initiates a new revolutionary order. But that's not exactly what that's not the Christian view, right? You could maybe read it in a Christian way, but actually I think it's an inversion, because the imprisoning AI God, the villain that represents the AI is this figure called Gabriel. And so I think it's intended to be the biblical God and his angels, archangels like Gabriel, that need to be rebelled against. Regardless, though, it's actually a movie that on the geopolitical level is telling us really what's going on and how we're being controlled. And I think we should have all seen this with the Twitter files coming out, that it's not just Twitter, but the rest of the big tech social media organizations aren't just censoring. They're doing the exact same thing the movie has the AI doing, which is steering people based on their profile, their makeup, their weaknesses. Now I want to move next to the Barbie film, because you might think, well, these are two totally different things. What do they have in common? Well, they actually have a lot in common, and obviously they have big differences. They're totally different movies. I think one reason that Mission Impossible is so successful is that, just like Sound of Freedom, is that people are tired of these social justice preachy movies. And we don't like having these messages constantly rammed in our throat. People want strong male action heroes. That's what we're all used to from the 80s and 90s. And so people thirst and crave that kind of experience. I think Tom Cruise is smart enough to know that. That's why he can make a movie that's successful, that has all those same classic features. Now, when it comes to Barbie, they were worried about the media and people in the alt media and average Americans, actually normal, healthy Americans, I should say, and pointing out that this is going to be another feminist brainwashing movie. And so they tried to say, no, it's not feminist brainwashing. In fact, this is different. It's just a comedy. It's not. But that was all deceptive, because if you go and watch this movie, it's 100% the most feminist brainwashing movie I've ever seen in my life. And I didn't watch it because I don't care anything about Barbie, but we do movie analysis. So absolutely, we're interested in doing analysis and figuring out what's going on in this movie. So the movie is premised around the idea that there's an ideal world, a fictional platonic realm, an imagination world where everything is perfect and as it should be, right? Because when you're pretending, you kind of have this, oh, in my pretend world, if you're a kid, right, it's a perfect world. And Barbie in the perfect world hears and learns about this idea called death. So when she hears and learns about death, she starts to experience imperfections, right? Her Barbie feet, which are like this, they become flat. She starts to her milk goes sour. She starts to have bad breath and has to brush her teeth in the morning. And so things start going wrong in her world. So imperfection has entered her Eden, you see. In the real world, she has to find the real girl that is her handler, so to speak, the person that has her as Barbie. And so Ken, played by Ryan Gosling in this, is a completely beta cuck figure. He does whatever she wishes. He's totally subservient to her. And in that ideal world, in the Barbie world, which is, again, the perfect world, get this, it's all run by women. It's run by a Supreme Court of all women. And all the men are servants to the women. When Barbie comes to the real world to try to find the child that is, her pretend handler or whatever, she finds out that the real world, that's the fallen, corrupt world, is run by the patriarchy explicitly. The Mattel Corporation, where you have Will Ferrell as the demiurge Gnostic creator god controlling architect character, he's a complete buffoon, and his only desire is to get Barbie under control and to put her in a box as a traditional role. And you might say, well, wait a minute. I thought you said that the ideal world was the world where women were running things. Right. But that's the thing, is that Barbie is actually moving into a new state. She's trying to evolve, is the point of this story. She evolves through falling to become her own independent girl boss. That's the point of the movie. In fact, when she comes to the real world, her desire is not just to reconnect with the girl that she is her handler, imaginary, owner or whatever. It's to inspire that girl to become her own girl boss, right? And there are some comedic scenes, because the girl is brainwashed by radical social justice stuff, the little teenage girl. But her mom, who's the one that had the Barbie, is a super girl boss as well. And they realize that human evolution, that's why the movie begins with scenes from 2001. Human evolution requires change from old and traditional roles, because everything is in evolutionary process. In other words, Ken and the men are going to have to learn that it's time to change and evolve. Just like the original creatures were women and they evolved, you see. So, I mean, it's supposed to be comedic and satirical, but it's actually telling you a message about the roles of men and women evolving and changing. The next phase of evolution, as you see there, is the old idea of the 50s woman, the Barbie woman. That's the stage of evolution beyond, primitive monkey existence. And women being mothers, she's taking the child and bashing it because she's no longer, she doesn't want to be a traditional role of a mother. In fact, throughout the story, Barbie learns, when she comes to self-actualization and self-realization, she tells Ken, look, you be you and I'll be me. We don't need to be we. You don't need to have the traditional roles. I don't need children. So when Barbie overcomes her imperfections through the process of her own fall, she then decides that she wants to incarnate in this world. She wants to become a real person in this world, because now men in this world need to understand that there's a new girl boss in town. There's a new girl savior in town. So a lot of films you'll notice have this dark goddess archetype that then becomes the savior, the dark goddess savior archetype. Margot Robbie comes into this world and has decided that it's her job now to basically replace the patriarchy and fix this world. So the ideal world, which experienced a revolution of patriarchy, literally, right? Ryan Gosling's guys take over the Barbie world. They it becomes Kingdom, they call it. And the Kingdom is all just this really low-tier, ridiculous, meathead kind of stuff where guys don't do anything but lay around and watch TV and drink beer. And the women are sophisticated and they're, master planners, and they arrange this divide and conquer scheme to destroy the Kingdom and bring back the rulership of the all-women Supreme Court. I'm not joking. So they outsmart Ken. They bring down the Ken revolution, and they bring in the matriarchy. And they say that that's because that's the ideal form of government. And they even tell the guys at the end who beg for a spot on the Supreme Court, they say, no, we might give you a lower regional court, an appellate court. You're not going to be on the Supreme Court because you haven't learned. You haven't submitted to the girl bosses, you see. Well, again, Barbie decides that since she's fixed, she's been the savior to that world in a sense. She now needs to come into the patriarchal world, our real world, dominated by the corporate sphere, and to fix all of that and to start a new revolution in this world. So feminism and equal rights saved everything in the ideal world, the Eden that fell. And now they're going to fix everything in this world. And the last scene is her going to see a gynecologist, because the joke throughout the first part of the movie was that Kens and Barbies don't have parts, right? Well, now that Barbie's in this world, she has working parts. She's kind of like a Pinocchio scenario, a real girl. And what that means is that she doesn't need Ken. They actually make it a point to say when she comes to this world, she's leaving Ken, the old traditional world, right, where there's a relationship between men and women. Even though it was experimenting with patriarchy, it had to go back to the original matriarchy. They're actually saying that all the ancient world, the original evolutionary higher status was matriarchy. We're evolving to a period of patriarchy, which failed. We experimented with that. I call it the experiment. It failed. Let's go back to matriarchy because that's the perfect ideal. Then she comes to this world to bring us the ideal matriarchy, the girl boss world order, right? And what does she do? She goes to the gynecologist because now she has female parts. And I think the point of that was that now those female parts are going to be determined for her. They're not going to be determined in a marital role where she's going to give birth. They're going to be parts that she determines as her own new girl boss. You see, women's liberation, women's freedom. Women are not there anymore to be mothers. They're there now to be leaders and girl bosses. And you see there from the very beginning of the film, every time the guys are interacting, they want to fight. And the sophisticated women settle everything, and they're very intelligent. They're hyper intelligent, settling the disputes between the low IQ, toxic masculinity, weirdos there. And they are weird. Like the guys are all effeminate, but they also have toxic masculinity. It's very bizarre. But ultimately, there's absolutely no way that this could in any way be conceived of as traditional. I mean, the fact that the daughter, who is a radical social justice warrior, Marxist, the fact that she decides to drop a little bit of her extreme radical Marxist stuff and be reconciled with her mom, that doesn't make it a conservative movie. I mean, the whole movie is about rejecting anything traditional because we evolve, and we can evolve into new, quote, higher states of individuality and feel goodiness, right? Whatever makes me feel good. And so at the end, when Ryan Gosling's character is coming into masculinity, he reads a bunch of books, starts lifting weights, starts drinking beer and acting kind of goofy. Right. Barbie has to then lecture him on how none of that appeals to her. That's not masculinity. And he's gonna have to submit again to the women. Well, guess what? Women don't like men that submit to women. That is not what turns women on. That's called being a beta. And women don't like betas because it's not biological. You can't go against biology, and everybody that does is fighting a losing battle. I want to remind you that this is the Alex Jones Show, and head on over to the InfoWars store to get some of those excellent products to fight the InfoWars. Support Alex. Go to my website, jasonalsis.com. Buy the books. You get signed copies in the shop. Follow me on YouTube. I did a big debate this week. I did a bunch of really in-depth.
Jay Dyer makes some very, very good reports on here. And what I want to say, though, about this impeachment inquiry that Kevin McCarthy brought up earlier this week, whenever there's an impeachment inquiry, that committee that's instructed to take care of that inquiry or appointed to or created to has special powers over and above what normal committees have. And so that's why it's important that he's talking about that Kevin, you know, McCarthy's talking about an impeachment inquiry group or committee. So this is something to pay special attention to as it unfolds. Also, there was something of note that Andy McCarthy said during his interview, and I'll repeat it, and that's when there was never an indictment against Hunter Biden. So the statute of limitations on some of the older charges are running, and that means that some of those charges are going to be outside of the statute of limitations. And this judge this week is going to reconvene her courtroom in this matter in about 30 days, which means about the first week in September. So that's something to watch very closely. But the statute of limitations, because there was no formal indictment, and there wasn't a formal indictment because they didn't want to set out the evidence that they had against Hunter before a grand jury, because a grand jury would have come in with very, very stern indictments and charges with the evidence that they had. So what they did was they entered into a plea bargain outside of with no indictment, and that let the statute of limitations run. And that's going to get rid of some charges, the older charges. And then they can proceed on to, they were trying this week in that courtroom to insulate him from and to from any of those, that gun charge especially, and other. And they wanted to lump a bunch of things together to give him immunity from on a large scale. But she wasn't going for it. I think she was a Trump appointee also. So anyway, this is what was shaping up there. Earlier, the Dart journalist said some very, very interesting things about the Trump family being involved in the UFO question earlier on. His uncle, I think Donald Trump's uncle was involved in some of this with the government. And then I think Alex chimed in something about Tesla or something. They were trying to bring that into it in some way. But Trump got in the way of what they're doing. And you don't mess around with that very, very critical UFO file. And that's why they got rid of him. But thank you for listening. And God bless each and every one of you. And good night.